friend of mine does work for Lockheed Martin, and I had a chance to visit his facility once. What a nice environment. With your interest in space, have you ever dreamed about working directly in one of those clean rooms, doing the assembly of something like a Curiosity or a Tejas? Have you ever dreamed about that, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Oh, yeah. In my business, what I did was they'd send us from job to job. We were in the piping industry. We would do everything from heating, air conditioning, hydraulics, and once in a while they'd send us to Grumman, either in Bethpage or at Calverton. And, you get out there and you see some of the work that was going on with the F-14s at the time, and all the work they would do to keep not only people out, but material and dust and everything. It was pretty interesting. But to actually work in an area where they're building something like the LEM, well, that predated my time, but that would have been great. Brookhaven Lab. I came close to that kind of atmosphere out there. But always from a distance, we were at an outside contractor doing something else. You'd get in, in to see what the real scientists were doing, All you could do is be an observer, but that was pretty cool. Back to you, Dave.
Have you had a chance to go to some of those beautiful summertime open house displays at Brookhaven Laboratory? Over to you, Paul.
Well, luckily, the contract that we had, they'd send two of us in, or maybe four at the most. Never anything too huge. And they would, and what would happen after a while, you start talking to somebody, maybe at the cafeteria or whatever, and then they would give you almost like a private tour. They walk this way, they take you about as far as you can go. But they would explain things here and there. I got past some of the locked doors that they had. They'd open it up and walk you through. Nothing was going on at the time. And they'd say, this is that, and this is that. And I was in a light source recovery building. What struck me, walking through down to Zeph Brookhaven now, what struck me there is all the aluminum foil all over everything. With this aluminum foil, they must do like rolls and rolls of this stuff. They wrap everything with it. I don't know. I guess it does something. I forgot what it does, but I mean it's all over everywhere. Back to you, sir.
In some cases, I think it's thermal insulation, but I'm not sure. But they do some interesting things, and it would be a fun place to work. Guarantee you'd enjoy it. And one last question, have you ever had a chance to get into their big particle accelerator? You did see the light recovery place, but the great big particle accelerator, the alternating gradient synchrotron. Ever see any of those tunnels up, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
It was funny, in the year, I guess probably 1979, probably 79, they had the Isabel project. And I was this 2.5 mile circumference ring that was completed. And they wanted to make a big atom smasher. They called it Isabel. And that was an acronym for something. I forget what that was. And then the years went by, and sure enough, they resurrected it under what they call the RIC program, the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collapse Project. They used the same 2.5 mile circumference ring, and they actually built this thing and completed it. And we got there, before it was completed. I mean, they were building. I saw all the mill rights and everything. They were setting everything that was going to carry all the gigantic tubes that could go all around the whole circumference. felt like you were in, I don't know, a train station when you start walking through this thing. And we had some heaters and things that we had to install, but I got to see the actual building of the RIC program.
Did you get a chance to see any of the actual target areas where they've got instrumentation? Because some of those are very large rooms with some really big machinery. Are they back to you, Paul?
Yeah, I was in the Atlas room, at the Phoenix room, and having to work over there. That was done by other people, same contractor. But I would say it was the Atlas room, and that's where, that's another actor, fancy, whatever they were going to crash into, it was a detector. So they were like, these atoms were going to hit this detector, and that was the room that we were in. That was Bravo Lodge. So you're in this, say, 15, 20-foot diameter space. It got even larger. I mean, I don't know. It had to be 50 feet diameter. I mean, it's nothing like Geneva, of course. You know, that looks like a building inside of the size of a 10-story building inside of one of the tubes that exit. Hit that detector, you know, so probably look at that and figure about maybe 25% of that size. So I guess that would be, what, 40 feet high? Back to you, sir.
Yeah, I've got a book on the machine, the CERN machine, with some pictures of their detectors. Wow. And like you said, it looks like a 10-story building in height and width, and that's just a detecting device. Alice and I can't even think of the names of some of them now. Four major detectors, and John, I think you were telling me today that the Higgs boson that they've discovered, they're not sure it is the main one they're looking for. They're just one of the subsidiary Higgs bosons, I think you mentioned. I may have your conversation confused with another one that I had today. And I believe you also told me, by way of an email, that they've discovered this very large structure in space, the biggest thing they've ever discovered. The biggest black hole, 14 to 20 billion solar masses. And the way a black hole works is that you double the mass, it doubles its diameter. It's a event horizon diameter. And you plug in the numbers for 14 billion, and I forget if it's either two or three times the radius of Pluto. Can you imagine a star two or three times the diameter of our complete solar system? My goodness, is that big. So give us a few words on what you've discovered space-wise recently, John. I think it was both this very large object and something about the Higgs boson. KC2WGB. Think big. KC2LIW. Very good, John.
All right, Dick. KC2WGB. Yes, if you want to look at it, if you go to space.com, and it's called the LQGC or LQC, Large Quasar Galactic Cluster. Now, we all know that where we live in our little galaxy, roughly 100,000 light years in diameter, this largest structure that they have found, and this came from Lancashire, England, they announced it a couple of days ago, it's 4 billion light years in diameter. And according to the astronomers, the mathematics that they are working with fails to predict anything this size. It really can't happen, but they know it has, so they're going to have some changes made. Very interesting. They never believed anything this size could exist. So that's space.com. If anybody wants to read about it, it's fantastic. I don't know how many quasars are involved, but it's a cluster of them. Its construct is huge.
And each quasi-stellar object, quasar, I think is something approximately the size of a galaxy, and in some cases they are very early galaxies that have not yet formed into their nice spiral arms and whatever. They're sort of a globular thing, elliptical thing. I believe that each one of them are believed to have a supermassive black hole in the center. So now you've got a cluster of quasi-stellar objects. The quasi-stellar objects tended to be very far away, very early objects in the birth of the universe by way of the Big Bang, is my understanding. So, once again, you build a detector for gamma ray bursts, and you wait long enough, you put it into space, something big enough is going to come along to saturate it. You think you found the biggest star, somebody's going to find a bigger one. You think you found the biggest black hole, you're eventually going to find a bigger one. You think you find the biggest galactic cluster, somebody's going to find a bigger one. Ain't no limit. I think Mother Nature, when she's setting up this universe, let me drop. She has not decided to make it simple and nice and easy for mankind to understand. And no matter how you define the word big, it's going to be exceeded. And we all have trouble understanding large numbers. The simple example I gave recently was that the Earth as we know it, we have good reason to believe, it's approximately 4.5 billion years old. Man-like animals, hominids, bipeds, we believe to have walked this Earth somewhere between 1 and 3 million years ago. And that sounds like 1 to 3 million years versus 4.5 billion years. Well, they sound like they're in the same ballpark. Not really. If you made a 24-hour clock that represents the life of planet Earth, 4.5 billion years, in the life of that clock, mankind represents the last 20 seconds of that 24-hour day. We've only been there for the last 20 seconds of that 24 hours. Of all the species that have ever existed on this planet, 99% of them are extinct. There's a huge number of ants, plants, and animals that you can analyze right now. Let me drop. Huge number of plants and animals on this planet right now. You can fill up books with them, just naming them. That represents 1% of the things that have formerly lived during that evolutionary process. 99% of all the past things are now extinct. Gives you kind of a humble feeling. You think you're really the major thing, been around for a long time, and you've had the most amount of influence. Not quite true. Were you also telling me something about the Higgs boson, John? Yeah, we found one, but it's not quite the major one we're looking for. That it really is one of the subsidiary Higgs bosons. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, that's right. First of all, what you had mentioned before, we're always talking about reciprocity. Now, to imagine big, how big, and then there's something bigger. Well, the reverse. Look what we're doing at CERN. We're looking deeper and deeper into the small. So those numbers, whether increasingly smaller and smaller or bigger and bigger, basically it's the same thing on either end of the spectrum. So we don't know if we're in the middle. Let me let it drop and I'll go on about the boson. Okay, the Higgs boson, they're almost positive what they found is the Higgs boson. They're like 99.9%. But they don't know if it's the standard model boson. The reason why it deteriorated into photons much too quickly. They don't think it's the standard boson. They think it's something close to it. So now the boson has possibly several different particles. And this is what they believe, why they're looking for that, is because that's what gives mass to the proton. And that's why we're hunting for it so fervently. So they're close, but they're not sure, and they think maybe another year before they'll be able to tell. But look at what they've, how far they've gone so far, and they've really just started. What, they have it running 2 years now?
Yeah, the Large Hadron Collider had one shut down because of a failure, and I think they're about to go to another dormant period in which they do another update so that they have the ability of doubling the power of that machine. So I think we're about to go through a down period, or a relaxation period, and when they come back, they're now going to be doubling it and looking even deeper yet. Is that approximately what your reading has shown, John? I haven't been keeping track of this one. KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Yes, Dick, I know they're going to increase it. I don't know if it'll be double, but it's going to be a quantum move forward, for sure. The other thing is, too, I'm trying to think of what else was important. Oh, if you remember, I remember the original estimate of what full power, was it 17 trillion electron volts? Do you remember?
I seem to remember 7 giga electron volts. I think it was 7, but I'm not sure. 3.5 plus 3.5 meaning 7. When you got two colliding beams of each 3.5 giga electron volts and you put them together, you just add them. It's a simple addition, even though you would think it would be square law. It's not. And I think it was 7 giga electron volts. But I've got the book. It's 5 feet away from me. If you stand by, I'll go get the book. Talk for about a minute while I go get the book, John. K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, I'll try. Yeah, I've been following that, and the experiments that they've done, they've gleaned a lot of data. Of course, this all has to go through all this computer processing and people reviewing it. They probably have a year's work for every month of data collection. Now, I don't know how they're going to be able to accelerate that, but they're going to have to find a way, because otherwise they're going to have to shut the thing down. They're not going to be able to keep up with it. I don't know when they're going to go back online. I seem to remember June as one of the dates, but they're going to have some excellent discoveries. I see a lot of stuff coming from there. And maybe what's going to be really interesting is new products. That's the next thing I think we're going to see coming out of CERN. We're going to actually be able to create structures a little differently than we have now. Maybe things more durable or things that are stronger. We don't know. All right. That's about a minute.
Yeah, the book that I'm talking about is entitled The Quantum Frontier, subtitled The Large Hadron Collider by Don Lincoln, forward by Leon Lederman, winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics. Unfortunately, this book is probably a little bit dated. I received my copy in July of 69. I'm looking to find out when this was copyright. Copyright 2009, Johns Hopkins University Press. So I'm already 2.5 years ancient here. So what they predicted then could be a little bit dated. But you would think in the index page, they would tell me... The main thing that I, as an engineer, want to know, how big, you know, how many gigapounds, how many gigadollars, and how many gigaelectron volts. I make a lot of fun. I have a lot of fun with the people I work with occasionally. I'll ask them, how many nanokilomegabucks do you have in your pocket? You know, do you have fun with units? Nanokilomega. Nano is 10 to the minus 9, kilo is 10 to the plus 3, mega is 10 to the plus 6. Minus 9 plus 3 plus 6 adds to 0. So 1 nanokilomegabuck happens to be $1. And so it takes people, you know, they look at you kind of strange. It takes them a while to calculate that, figure out what it means. And I say, well, you guys deal in small amounts of money, nanokilomegabucks. I deal in the bigger chunks of money, mega-mega-pico-dollars. In reality, you're not supposed to combine units like that, the original meaning of those units. You don't combine large and small units in the same structure. But theoretically you can. So during the next few minutes, I'll try to scan this book and find out how many gigaelect repeater.
Time out. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
27 kilometers in diameter, right?
Yes, that's the same. The 27 kilometers in diameter, that didn't change. But the gig of electron volts that they predicted that they were going to be able to do in 2009 versus what they can do today, that number could have changed a little bit, particularly after that that meltdown of a couple of the magnets. There's a huge amount of energy. When you store these extremely strong magnetic fields in these superconducting magnets, the amount of stored energy there is just out of sight. And if anything goes wrong, where one of those magnets loses its superconductivity, where you've got thousands of amperes flowing in a superconducting wire with no voltage drop and no power being dissipated. Let me drop. And you get a bad joint, a bad crimped connector on one of those superconducting wires, where a milliohm of resistance takes place, maybe even a microohm, and you get thousands of amperes flowing through that milliohm. Let's see, thousands of ampere and a milliohm, you got volts being dropped, but volts being dropped at 1,000 volts. So 1 volt of drop across one tiny little junction represents 1,000 watts of dissipation in that tiny little junction that may be a couple of millimeters wide. You pump 1,000 watts of heat into something a millimeter wide, and you're going to get smoke and flames real fast. And that local heating starts spreading. And so the heating will then make the adjacent piece of wire no longer thermally conductive, no more superconductive. And pretty soon this huge magnetic field being sustained by that thousands of amperes of superconducting current, that magnetic field starts collapsing. All of that huge amount of energy you pumped into that magnet to bring it up to that number of Tesla of magnetic field, you're going to get it all back, whether you want it or not. It's going to come flying back out of you, at you. Tremendous amounts of local voltage and heating will take place. That, in turn, will create what looks like a local explosion of the liquid helium you got in the doer around that thing. That, in turn, is going to create all kinds of fancy mechanical shock that's going to rip that magnet off of its mounting. The adjacent magnets, they're going to be disturbed, and you start a cascade, as you can see. You read any of the reports of what happened during that simple failure they had a couple of years ago. I think it cost them $2 billion, or quite a few megabucks in order to replace all that. You probably have more of those details than I do, John. KC2W.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Go ahead, John. KC2WGB. K2IW.
How many nanokilo megabucks did, but it was sure a lot, that's for sure. I don't remember the figures, but it was something they really didn't realize how much damage that could cause. They thought it would have to be a bigger failure, but it was a very tiny failure. I believe it was a leak, and that was it. And don't forget, Dick, you did want to go on about your transformer. Maybe you want to finish that, too.
WSLN, I'm showing how many electronic bulbs on the internet.
Go right ahead, Paul.
According to the Journal, I'm not sure what this is about, but this website says it's 8 trillion. They've raised it to 8 trillion. It started off around 2.8 back in 09. Now they're up to 8 trillion. Now I guess they're going to go higher than that if they're going to shut it down.
Where's your book out, Dick?
Oh, hold on now. 8 trillion is really 8 giga. Wait a minute. No. It's 8 tera. Let's see. Billion is giga. See, mega is million. Billion is giga. We're talking about tera. Oh, yeah. Maybe I'm not reading the book correctly. So maybe we're talking about 8 tera electron volts. That's a lot of energy. Paul first and then John in that order. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, that's all I'm seeing on some website, the Journal, IE.ie, whatever it is. It's a report on what they did recently. So it's dated as a couple of days ago. So they're showing 8 trillion, and it looks like they started out at 2.45 on another website a few years ago. But that means they doubled that and then went up even higher. And according to John, they're going to shut this thing down. It's going to be higher than this. I was looking for that. I'd like to find out what they're going to go up to. John?
I had the number 17 trillion, but evidently that's an error. Yeah, it'd be interesting if you could find that. And, Dick, I guess that information was the best they had at the time. He's saying 2009, and that's about where he was quoting for. So, yeah, that's a big error. Increase, I should say.
A trillion is tera. Billion is giga. Tera. That's 10 to the 12. A tera electron volt is 10 to the 12. And 10 to the 12, I think, is trillion. Really big numbers. And it's amazing how close you are to the speed of light. I think it's
9 nines.
5 nines. How many nines is it, John?
9.
9 nines. Whoa. What's the name of the British guy who works there, who is always being quoted on? He's the local Carl Sagan, so to speak. This particular British scientist, fairly young guy, looks like he's about 35 years old, gives these lectures on, what's the name of this, what's the name of this series of lectures that they hold periodically? It's got a three-letter abbreviation. Over to you, John.
He's British, very smooth-talking young fellow. I do not know. He also hosts the show, I believe it's called The Universe.
There's quite a few YouTube videos that are very entertaining to listen. And him, just like Dick Feynman, and now Neil deGrasse Tyson, there's also a lot of lectures given to him in which he's giving some very nice explanations, just like Carl Sagan used to do. Johnny Carson used to have Carl Sagan on quite often. Johnny Carson also owned a pretty good-sized telescope, although where he lived in Los Angeles, I don't think he had a chance to use it very much. I've recently received, as a Christmas present, a book on astronomy, which shows you the exact same camera, the exact same film, the exact same exposure time, done in a urban area versus a suburban area, a rural area, where the exact same chunk of sky is being photographed on very clear nights, 3 days apart. What a huge difference. The average person living in a metro area, let me drop it, really doesn't have the vaguest idea what the sky looks like. And once in a blue moon, you'll have a blackout where the power fails for that city, and people see the sky for the first time in their life, and they think something is wrong. What is that white smeary patch on the sky? It's not a cloud. It doesn't move. And what's all of those dots all over the place? They're seeing stars for the first time they've never seen. They're seeing the Milky Way for the first time in their life. They don't even have the situation where their father described it to them in their youth. If you lived in a metro area, you probably can only see the first or second level of stars, magnitude. And when you in a rural area, you can see six and a half magnitudes of stars. Huge difference in the number of stars. Thousands and thousands of stars of difference between what you see in a city versus what you see rural. The amount of flare light, I mean, the so-called safety lighting for all of your streets and parkways and parking lots and everything else, lights up the sky in ways that are just out of sight when it comes to what's really there. Early mankind was very busy finding all of these diagrams of all these star configurations. Let me drop them.
VE3ZTZ with info.
Go ahead, VE3ZTZ. KQLIW, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen, and everyone on the net tonight. I just have the collider info. It's scheduled to go to 6.5 TeV per beam by late 2014, with the ultimate goal of ramping up to its full design energy level of 7 TeV per beam.
Okay, 7 TeV, Tango, Echo, Victor. 7 TeV per beam, which means when those two beams are head-on to each other, I think that equals 14 TeV. Is that true, Scott? Go ahead.
Affirmative.
I vaguely remember that...
The name that you were looking for was Brian Cox. That's it.
That's the guy. The Higgs boson, do you happen to remember, Scott, at what power level, at what TeV level was the discovery of the Higgs boson? VE3ZTZ, K2LIW?
They were theorized to occur between 7 and 8 TeV, which means you need beams of 3.5 to 4 TeV each. And that's the record that they broke last year by hitting the 3.5 TeV per beam is what they've just shut down at.
So I now the... have they already shut down? I think you're saying they're shut down until later of 2014 for this upgrade that allows them to get to TeV, 6.5 or 7 TeV per beam. And I think in order to do that, they're literally going to go that much higher in the strength of the superconducting magnetic sustained fields. So the total amount of stored magnetic energy is about to go up. Proportionally, you have to have a stronger magnet to keep that beam going into that circle of that tunnel, a 27-mile circumference circle. And so with that greater stored energy, if anything goes wrong, you're going to get a bigger bang. Is that about the way you see it, Scott? VE3ZTZ, K2LIW?
Well, I was reading an article from Scientific American... that came along that said this hadron is the last of the classic physics experiments. That once this once the Higgs boson is proven, which it seems it has, the Standard Model issues up for grabs a little bit, which is why they need to up it just a little bit more to prove it. That this is the everything's been proven out from most of Einstein's and Newton's and all that work. So once they go to these higher voltages, they're not expecting to, not find new things. They're not expecting to find any new theoretical physics out of this, VE3ZTZ.
Scott? I'm going to assume you're a gambling man. How much would you be willing to bet when they go that extra distance of the higher energy, something like 14 TeV total, what's your guess that they're going to find something that was unexpected? If you were a betting man, how much money would you put on that? I would put a reasonable amount of money that they're going to find something they didn't expect to find. VE3ZTZ, K2LIW.
I'm not taking that bet. Since I was in high school and learned about, you know, atom and proton and these neutrons and things like that, and just the vaguest mention in high school, physics and chemistry of quarks. It just, you know, that was glanced. The number of pages of the textbook that you have to rip out and rewrite between when I was in high school and now is just phenomenal. It's also amazing how much was right, how much Einstein and people like that got right with a, you know, a slide rule and a chalkboard. That still continues to amaze me. So I'm not taking that bet. The sister article in Scientific American that did catch my attention as things that make you go, is absolute zero was regarded as a number, zero. That's it. Can't go below it. And there's been a series of reproducible experiments where they're now doing negative Kelvins. And you can go below absolute zero. It's a funky energy state that causes a shift in the phasing of quantum behavior. So if you
think of the vibration, the particles goes up and down, up and down, up and down. You take it to zero, they're still. You take it to negative Kelvin, and instead of going up and down, they resume motion, and you want to think of it now as like left, right, left, right, left, right. And this makes for things like, theoretically, steel material is as strong as steel, but flexible like rubber. And there's going to be new product science come out of that. They know it. They can see it already. But negative Kelvin was one of the more interesting things that popped up in 2012. The E3ZTZ.
Yeah, I've been subscribing to Scientific American for a good number of years. And I think you're describing either the December 2012 or the January 2013 issue, which I haven't read all the way yet. And so, science as we know it is an evolving body of knowledge that gives useful information to mankind, lets you know how things work. But since it is continuously evolving, today's best truth is not going to be as good as the one you're going to get tomorrow in general. In the chemistry classes you and I took in college, Scott, we had very simplistic diagrams of what a proton, neutron, nucleus, and an electron cloud around that nucleus as a element or a molecule, what it really looked like. In reality, it's a lot more complicated than that. Those orbitals, we talk about this, these various rings of orbits of those electrons. Let me drop. But they're not at all simple. If I was designing a water molecule, where I'm going to put two hydrogens and one oxygen together, and I know that the two hydrogens are both, have got a pretty strong negatively charged cloud of electrons around them, therefore they're going to be tacked onto this oxygen molecule, and they want to repel each other, I would have put one hydrogen molecule up at 6 o'clock and one of them up at 12 o'clock on this oxygen molecule. You know, draw your 12 clock points around the oxygen molecule. I put one hydrogen up at 12 o'clock and one at 6 o'clock. That's the way I would have designed a water molecule. Mother Nature didn't do it that way. Those two hydrogen molecules are something like 110 degrees apart from each other. Why that number? Did that become clear in any of the physics and chemistry classes you took, Scott? Why 110 degrees apart? It's not exactly 110, but it's in that neighborhood. 109.091 or some crazy. Why that number of degrees apart? VE3ZTZ, K2RIW.
The reason it's 110 degrees apart is so that when water freezes, it'll bust your pipe.
Okay, because the two molecules are lumped together on one side, that makes more water a bipolar molecule, and that gives it a lot of the magic qualities. Why does this crazy substance have maximum density at 4 degrees centigrade, and you go to lower temperatures, it expands, you go to higher temperatures, it expands? Why 4 degrees centigrade, maximum density? And because those two hydrogen molecules are at one end, that means one end of the water molecule is positive and the other end is negative, so it responds very nicely to a microwave oven and gives you lots of heating. And so I think you're saying that the way the water molecules form a lattice, that's what ice really is, the way it forms a lattice, somehow crazy expansion takes place when you go to colder temperatures instead of the normal contraction. How come the thermal expansion rate of water slash ice has got this crazy dip in the curve? Has that been made clear to you, Scott? If so, are you going to keep that a secret from us? P3ZTZ, K2RIW.
Sorry, I guess the Canadian repeater doesn't repeat the sarcasm. Murphy's Law prevails through all of this, and that's why 110 degrees breaks your pipes, because somebody has a sense of humor and ingredient Murphy's Law.
But Scott, You have heard of Elmer's Law, haven't you? Have you heard of Elmer's Law? The subsidiary to, or to the subsequent law to Murphy's Law? Over to you, Scott.
I believe so, yes.
Okay, you've heard it, and many other people have heard it, but a few who have not. Elmer's Law states that Murphy was an optimist, the real world's a little worse. Yeah, whereas Murphy was, if anything can possibly go wrong, it will. So, I guess we could give each other a homework assignment. Why in the world are those two hydrogen molecules 110 degrees apart on a water molecule? Why in the world does water expand when it's frozen instead of contract like most other things do? It's awful glad, we're awful glad that it does. That makes ice float. And because ice floats, a lot of life at the bottom of a frozen pond is allowed to continue through the winter. A lot of good things happen because of that. And it's probably related to why water is a polar molecule and therefore will respond to a microwave oven. Water is also, because it's a polar molecule, it's a very universal solvent. There's a hell of a lot of things that will dissolve in water that will not dissolve in many other substances. And it's a real good complement to carbon, hydrocarbon molecules as far as sustaining life is concerned. And when it comes to, let me drop, when it comes to older people, and I'm one of them, a significant percentage of the population, from my point of view, develops what I call mature onset sodium sensitivity. You continue to consume salt-laden foods like you did in your youth. In your older years, there's a 50-50 chance, depending on your genetics, it's going to give you a lot of grief. There were two very significant articles in the New England Journal of Medicine and also the Journal of American Medical Association. Roughly 2009, I'm not sure the exact year of the article, 2008, 2009, which represented a very large survey, which came to the conclusion that between 90,000 and 140,000 Americans per year would not die of coronary artery disease if they would simply lower their sodium intake in their diet. When you read the significance of the amount of research that went into those articles and what it's saying, it says something pretty strong. Sodium is a beautiful preservative for, it can drastically increases the shelf life of your food. I now look at the labels and tend to buy very low sodium foods for a whole bunch of reasons. I ran into a health problem 4 years ago that drastically got improved when I lowered my sodium intake. So I buy low sodium cereal. Let me drop. The good news is that once you acquire the taste for low-sodium foods, it tastes the same to you. I'd suffer no real disadvantage. But you buy low-sodium low-sodium cereal, you better eat it in the first month or so, otherwise the bugs will take over. It was the sodium in our food that was killing the bugs. If it kills the bacteria and kills the bugs, what does it do to humans? I talked to a few people going to medical school where one of the experiments they do is to look under a microscope of bacteria in a solution, that they increase the saline-ness of the solution, and by osmosis, they watch the cells of the bacteria absorb extra water and explode because of the sodium content. And you'd be amazed how many human beings will have water retention if they eat excess sodium in their diet. And you'd be amazed how many people think that if they stop using the salt shaker, that they're safe. Uh-uh. You better study the labels on your food. You look at every one of those cans of Campbell's soup, you'll be amazed how much salt is in them, and Chef Boyardee foods, for instance. Or I used to think that Cheerios and Raisin Bran were very safe cereals. Not anymore. You only need, for my research, you only need between 200 and 500 milligrams of sodium per day. And yet they're recommending diets of 2,500. I think that number is much too high for my particular genetics of my family. I know you guys didn't expect all that. How I got into that subject, I don't know. Let's see now. Last thing we discussed last week, let me drop, was Transformers. And if you go to Bernie's website, huntfamily.org, I think it is, or is it huntfamily.com? I think it's huntfamily.org. You'll see that I've recommended that you take a look at this 9.5-minute video done by this really beautiful physics professor at MIT. And you look at this very simple diagram, which consists of a 1-volt battery in series with two resistors, a 100-ohm resistor and a 900-ohm resistor. So you got a total of 1,000 ohms on 1 volt by Ohm's law and Kirchhoff's equations. You've got exactly 1 milliampere flowing in that loop of those two resistors. Let me drop. So you put a ideal voltmeter across the 900-ohm resistor, and you'll measure 9-tenths of a volt. Put an ideal voltmeter across the 100-ohm resistor, you'll measure 1-tenth of a volt. And depending on how you set up them, the voltmeters, polarity-wise, maybe one of them will be 0.9 positive and the other one 0.1 negative, but I think they're both going to be 0.1 positive. So you add, by Kirchhoff's law, the total voltage drops across the two resistors adds to 1 volt. The total voltage drop across the battery is 1 volt. By Kirchhoff's law, if you go in one particular direction and obey the signs correctly, any single loop that you analyze in a steady state, in a non-dynamic circuit, you will measure 0 volts in any one single loop. And he goes through that experiment, actually makes the measurement, actually does it on a blackboard, and it's hunky-dory. Let me drop.
BayDickets.com on Bernie's.
Okay, so it's Bernie@huntfamily.com. All right, you go to that website and you'll see the recommendation for the URL for this beautiful 9.5-minute. I've got two of them in there, but it's only the first one that really you have to look at. The first one is the chalkboard explanation, and the second one is where he actually does it as a real experiment on an oscilloscope. But you don't have to look at that one. The first one is the main one. And so, when it comes to a steady-state battery and two resistors and ideal voltmeters, everything is nicely explained. Let me drop. The next thing this beautiful MIT physics professor does is to remove the 1-volt battery, 1-volt battery, and substitute it with a short circuit. Then he puts in the middle of this ring of two resistors, the 100-ohm resistor and the and the 900-ohm resistor, he puts I'm going to call it a solenoid, a magnetic field-producing device, a solenoid. And when you get by way of Lenz's law or Faraday's law, a changing magnetic field will induce a predictable amount of voltage in a ring of conductors that are around it. So this ring that consists of the wiring of these two resistors are around the solenoid magnetic field, call it a bar magnet if you like, but it is a bar magnet which is going in the positive direction, changing magnetic field at the instant of observation. And he makes that clear. It's a changing magnetic field, and he's going to analyze it at one particular instant in which the magnetic field is changing at such a rate that in this loop it's going to produce a voltage of 1 volt. And sure enough, when it does that, the rate of change of magnetic field produces 1 volt in the loop, no battery there, you get exactly 1 milliampere flowing. And now you put the voltmeter across, first the 900-ohm resistor, and later through across the 1-ohm, the 100-ohm resistor, and you think you're going to measure 0.9 volts and 0.1 volts, respectively, and you think you're going to measure them with a certain polarity. And you sort of do, but you soon realize you're putting the voltmeter in the exact same location. When the voltmeter is positioned to the right...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Mm-hmm. I see we're about to run out of time. We're not going to complete this one tonight. My goodness, the time went fast. So I guess I'll tell you that what's going on in this circuit, and we'll discuss it more next week, really is very relevant with the reference to a transformer. If you're able to understand what that professor telling you in this so-called mind-blowing experiment, you'll have a hell of a lot more understanding of how a transformer works and why you've got to do certain things to the primary winding to make it work correctly. And at first, things do not add up correctly. So transformers have got some really crazy characteristics that have got to be investigated. So we're not going to get through that tonight, I can tell. Anybody want to make any other final comments? Because we've only got about 1.5 minutes left before we're about to be cut off. This was TechNet number 4132 of the series. I'll first pass it over to John for any comments he wants to make, and then anybody else will get a chance after that. KC2WGB, K2RW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, I recommend that they go to Bernie and take a look at that. Very interesting, and you may have to watch it a couple of times to get exactly what's happening there. But a lot of information, and I don't want to try this comment. KC2WGB, back to net.
Yeah, I suggest is also the subject. If next week you can pick up.
Good night, Dick.
Good night, both John and Wes. And we'll see you guys next week. We'll get a little bit deeper into all of the above. We'll almost figure out what the Hadron Lodge, the Large Hadron Collider is going to be doing for us. Guarantee it's going to find something new. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. K2LAW.
Echo 3 Juliet India Whiskey.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Has some definite thoughts on radio, and
he could do a dance on somebody on Echolink. Something you thought of, we can run an open 2 meter PL on a repeater in Toronto without getting jammed to oblivion. And the other thing, while I've got it, a VE3 Romeo Papa Tango is a repeater on a really big tower north and west of Toronto that covers over 100 miles in not mountainous terrain. A huge footprint repeater, biggest in the Toronto and surrounding area, that was carrying this Limelight TechNet. And I don't know who brought it up, but people are learning in the Toronto and the surrounding area about your Sunday night net. And I'll turn it over to K2RIW, the E3JIW in the group.
Yeah, thank you, Jim. That's good information. Hello, sir. Sierra, India. I think you said his email address is windsystems.lark, L-R-C or L-A-R-C, windsystems.lark. And what follows that? What is the suffix on that one, Jim? Back to you, K2LIW.
It's Win Whiskey India November System. They don't double up the S at the beginning of system. And it's dot Oscar Romeo Golf. Oscar Romeo Golf.
Now that's a new one as a suffix. Oscar Romeo Golf. I am curious, what do you think that stands for, Jim?
Organization. The non-profits, the Gutenberg.org, Mozilla.org, Netscape, all the orgs, the non-profits are orgs. I'm surprised, that question surprises me.
Like WNEQ.org. So where I goofed is that the, you said Oscar Romeo Golf, I wrote down Alpha Romeo Golf. ORG, now it makes a lot of sense. Okay. My phonetics need work. Okay, good information. That's brand new to me. There is another TechNet in New Jersey. There used to be another one on Long Island for a brief period of time. But there is one in New Jersey. And so now for the last 3 years, there's been one in California. Out of curiosity, is that the Los Angeles area or the San Francisco area or the San Diego area? What's your guess as to which portion of California Shorty is running that TechNet from? Whoever wants to take it, go ahead. K2LIW.
Shorty lives in Oregon and his server is probably in where? Scott, go ahead. VE3ZDZ8.
Sorry, I have to correct you there, Jim. Shorty does not, repeat, not live in Oregon. He's in Northern California. I think he says he's about 30 miles south of the Oregon border in a place called Smith River. Because of the 90-plus repeaters that are mostly up and down California, he runs the net from his home in Smith River, California, just south of the Oregon border, but the network, because these are permanently linked repeaters, the network runs ostensibly from top to bottom in California, so it hits all the cities, LA, San Francisco, and all the small counties, all the way down to San Diego, plus it's linked into Alaska, as I said, Hawaii, there's big participation, so these are permanently tied together repeaters, so when he keys down on his TechNet, it's a big transmit footprint. V3ZCZ.
Wow, you hear me on 375? I'm hearing you on 375. Now, 7:30 Friday night, that strikes me as prime time. See, the lucky thing I have is that on Sunday night, our local repeater used to be pretty quiet. And therefore, for running the TechNet, I didn't get very much flack on people saying that, hey, I'm a non-technical person, but you're booking our repeater. Friday night at 7:30 strikes me as prime time.